Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the NBL Pocket Podcast. I might change that name in the future, not sure. We last spoke on Tuesday. Today is Thursday, the 14th of May, and I hope you're all very well. First things first, rate, write a review, and subscribe to the NBL Pocket Podcast if you're a fan. This episode today is all about Andrew Gaze, Lindsay Gaze, and the Melbourne Tigers. When you ask people about the NBL GOAT or the greatest of all time, the answer that cracks back at you faster than the tail of a whip is more often than not Andrew Gaze. I watched the tail end of Gaze's NBL and Olympic career and thought he was a very good player, but when people say NBL and Andrew, I think Vlahov rather than Gaze. Not because I think Vlahov was the greatest, but because the Wildcats were the team, tied with the Adelaide 36ers, that won the most titles during Gaze's career and during the 41-year length of the league, and seemingly, they always will. I always thought Gaze was an accumulator, a confident shot taker and maker who rung up big numbers, but not necessarily a player who would break down and rip the heart out of defenders and defenses. Rather, his points came out of an offensive system that he was a virtuoso performer of. Now, that's no slight, but hey, that's just me. Gaze and the Tigers won as many grand finals as they lost, winning in 1993 and 97, losing in 92 and 96 to the South East Melbourne Magic. He was Australia's sweetheart and apparently gave no one a toothache. Basketball in Australia may as well have had Gaze incorporated at the end of it. The Last Dance with Jordan and the Bulls has come out and it's a social media rave. And it again got me, as I'm sure a lot of you, thinking about Gaze, the obvious NBL Michael Jordan comparison. Jordan's competitive nature meant he went from white-hot rage to burnout and back again in 93, 98, and finally in 2003. Gaze didn't have that type of career or mindset, seemingly. He played right up until he, or perhaps his father Lindsay, or both of them, were done with the game. Gaze has some stats that will never be broken, due partly to his performance, as well as the chopping and changing of the NBL rules and landscape over time. I wanted to talk to Boddy Nodge about Gaze and the Melbourne Tigers. Boddy's been around basketball in this country forever. He knows it like a rhinoplasty, and he's fiercely honest to boot. Boddy has stated before on this podcast that he thinks the NBL's greatest was Leroy Loggins, and I hope I'm not misquoting him there. Boddy praised Leroy's offense, defense, demeanor, and total control of a game over any other player. I pepper Boddy with questions like, why did the Gaze Tigers never finish on top of the ladder? Why did Gaze win 7 MVPs, 5 straight, but only one NBL title during his MVP years? Why did the Tigers struggle in their second through fourth years with Gaze? In that time, the Tigers went 22-80. How and why did the Tigers lose in the 96 Grand Final to the South East Melbourne Magic? Was the shuffle the best offense for the team, for the Melbourne Tigers, or was it the best offense for Andrew Gaze individually? Would they have had greater team success with a different system? Is there any truth to the Copeland is getting hotter than Andrew, better sub him out rumours? Did the boomers of the 2000s operate out of fear? Did that campaign and the re-implementation of the shuffle offense close to the Olympics seemingly stifle arguably the best crop of Australian bigs for Gaze's benefit? Can it all be that dramatic?
Yeah.
Now, just before we launch into this episode, if you're really interested in the history of the NBL and Gaze's place within it, buy a copy of Boddy's books, Marvelous. It's predominantly about 36ers guard Brett Maher, but it also serves as a handbook of the NBL. The other book, of course, is A Kid, A Ball, A Dream by Grantley Bernard. They're both wonderful books. I've read them both. I will leave links as to how you can contact the authors and buy a copy in the description of this episode. But nonetheless, here are the questions I peppered Boddy with in this episode of How Good Was Gaze? I hope you enjoy it. We'll talk about Andrew Gaze. If I can just assert my position on this. Okay. Born in 87, caught the tail end of Gaze's career, have seen highlights, have read your book and others. So I've got a relative idea, but obviously I've called you in, having been there and lived it and followed it. I'm going to start with this. And this sort of stumped me and people I've asked, what is Andrew Gaze's sort of one of or a few of his greatest moments? Jordan has the shot, the flu game, the so forth. What's Gaze's moments?
Well, I think you find one of the big moments for Gaze was the shot that tied the game, that sent the game into overtime against the Soviet Union in 1987 or 1988 at the Glasshouse in Melbourne, where the Boomers were playing against them. And that was a phenomenal game where he scored in the 40s. You know, it's memorable for lots of things. Not the least was the fact that afterwards when he was interviewed, they asked him what he would be doing post-game. He said having a shower and going having a Whopper with cheese at Hungry Jack's, which the GM of Hungry Jack's happened to be watching, and that was that led to the NBL sponsorship, original sponsorship with Hungry Jack's. They've got one again now. That was a big game, and another huge moment was back in 1989 when he was playing for Seton Hall, and they got to the NCAA final. The semi-final and the final were beamed in live into Australia on Channel 7. This is the sort of stuff that didn't happen, but Andrew was able to create sufficient interest in the sport that it did happen, and it hasn't happened subsequently. You know, in terms of an Australian sportsman playing, like Luke Sencha played for Georgia Tech in an NCAA final, but that wasn't sort of beamed in live because Luke. So Andrew, so that he immediately captured the imagination because of his ability to score. And so another huge one, you fast forward to the 2000 Olympics at the other end of his career, and they have to beat Italy. They have to beat Italy to get through to the semi-finals and have a chance at a medal. And he performs just above and beyond expectations at the point where in the press conference afterwards, the Italian coach says, you know, well, we were beaten by Mr. Gaze. Mr. Gaze, you know. Right. Lindsay got up and said, hey, I had nothing to do with it. Although they were running the show.
And Andrew's reply was what? He's getting McDonald's this time or KFC? Or?
Well, McDonald's was the official sponsor, so he was eating a nugget at the time. But anyway, so there.
And a nugget of chicken?
Yes, one would hope. And here in Adelaide, some of his most memorable games were at Apollo against the 36ers back in the day, and it was really Andrew versus the other team. And even if you go back further, I can remember West Adelaide game at Albert Park. So that would be 84, West Adelaide versus Melbourne Tigers. And Andrew is running rings around the entire defense of the Bearcats. Al Green can't do anything about him. David Spear can't do anything about him. Ray Wood can't do anything about him. He's sneaking back door. He's just in motion all the time. So when you say specific games, well, there's the one that I will always remember is the one against the Soviets and also the one against Italy. Both times he's playing for the national team as opposed to Melbourne Tigers, because the Melbourne Tigers.
What's the drop off there? Because I couldn't think of it. If I just specify the question and say what's his greatest NBL moment, it becomes a little bit more murky. And I don't know why. Maybe that's, is that a nature of the league or is that a nature of the way Gaze played in it? I don't know.
It's the nature of the way he played, because he wasn't spectacular. Like, he's not throwing down a dunk. You want to talk about Michael Jordan, you got some spectacular plays as reference points, whereas Andrew's coming down, pulling up, hitting a three, and that beats you. So you go, okay, well, he's fantastic, but maybe that doesn't live on in the memory in the same way. I have more memories of Andrew lobbing the ball for Leonard Copeland to dunk.
Right, yes, same.
Then probably of Andrew, because he was just continually scoring. He was perpetually in motion. If you took your eyes off him for a second, he'd backdoored you, he'd ducked here, he'd gone there, and he was getting the ball, and people go, how is he free? How the hell is he free?
He free? Do you think it was a result of defenses being bad or him just being crafty?
Oh, he was absolutely crafty, and the offense, the
not
shuffle
quick,
worked for him
crafty.
Too. Yeah. He was a scorer. Okay, you know, you got shooters and you've got scorers. He's probably a bit of both, but he would score, and it was as simple as that. He would get his points, and sometimes very simply. I had a conversation with Hall of Famer Ken Cole a while back about how to construct a score and how a lot of players today don't know how to construct a score. Where all you basically need, if you're having a bad day, is maybe you fight hard, you get a good front position, you get an offensive rebound, you get two quick points there. Maybe you do a little backdoor, you get two there, you get fouled, you go to the foul line, you got 6 points, that's the first quarter. You finished with 24 points.
Yeah,
and you've had a bad day.
Yeah,
now you're having a good day. You're finishing with 44 points. So Andrew is very good at constructing a score. He just kind of inherently, maybe not inherently, maybe it was taught to him over time, but he just knew how to do it. And so it wasn't that defenses were bad. I mean, this is a guy that's averaged 44 points in one season. Mm. So everybody was abundantly aware of his potential to blow you off the floor. So they were doing everything in their power to stop him.
Let's go right back. Let's go back to that rookie year. The Tigers go 11 wins, 13 losses. I think just finished out of the playoffs. I couldn't find it. He's 18 years old. He averages 30 points a game, 29.1 to be precise. Yeah. They win that year. They go 11 wins, 13 losses. Then the next 4 years, they win 5 wins, 6 wins, 3 wins, 8 wins. They basically go on a 4-year, you know, quite a bad losing streak. So my question is, what made that rookie year quite good and then the subsequent 4 years poor for mainly the Tigers, but also Andrew as well?
Well, that first year he had a better team when they first came into the league. Now, you have to remember the history of this is that Melbourne Tigers and St Kilda Saints back in the late 70s, they were the dominant clubs. The two Victorian teams are the dominant clubs. But Lindsay Gaze, who was the coach of the Melbourne Tigers, was very much hooked up with the Southeast Conference, I should say, which became the Southeast Australian Basketball League, SEABL, etc. Yeah. But it was, at that stage, that was an interstate competition that Lindsay had a lot to do with. And there was a feeling when they started up the National Basketball League that Lindsay would be trying to, you know, play that against the SEC, and that the SEC would be more important to him, that there'd be, he would be in some way trying to sabotage the National Basketball League. So his team wasn't invited. Now, that's a bit of a shock at the time, but in 79, the Melbourne Tigers were like one or two in the nation and were not invited to be part of this competition. Wow. And there was quite some kerfuffle about it, and that's why that first season they weren't called the National Basketball League. It was the National Invitation Basketball League because people kicked up because they hadn't been invited.
Wow.
So that was the NIBL in 1979. You can still find the logo for that with the I in it. So they were out. They were kept out of it. So when they actually came in 84, they were still a pretty decent VBA team. Still reasonably strong. They had Brian Gorgian playing for them. You know, so they had a reasonably good side. So they were able to immediately be competitive and finish around middle of the pack. They were okay. Mm-hmm. Subsequent to that, you know,
85 through 88.
I think they were basically running with a very low budget team. You know, there were very good Victorian players like Nigel Purchase and Ray Gordon, guys that sort of bled for Melbourne Tigers playing for them, but they weren't getting paid huge amounts of money. Their imports were very much stats conscious. I think they had Paul Stanley. He scored a lot of points, but, you know, scoring a lot of points seemed to be a bit more important than winning a lot of games. Right. And I'm not entirely sure that some of the imports that they had suited their system, because their system was the shuffle, always was the shuffle, always will be the shuffle, and nothing wrong with that. You know, I'm not a critic of the shuffle, having as a coach run the shuffle a few times myself with teams that were less talented, because it's an equal opportunity sort of offense. So, if you've got a less talented group, it's a very good offensive system to utilize. So that's how I'd explain that. They also didn't have much money. They were not, you know, flush with sponsors. They were like the family club, but literally the family club, where it wasn't the Gaze family, but just the family club. You know, we're doing barbecues to raise a bit of money. We're having a Lamington sale. Yeah, they were like at that end of the scale. So they didn't have huge
not,
amounts.
Not
of
even protocol. Crackles, just Lamingtons.
They may have had crackles.
Okay,
they're not hard to make.
I tell you what, I'll do some digging around. And I'll find out there were crackles and honey joys. Gaze's prime years, 26 years old to 32, 33, were 91 to 98. In that time, when Gaze wins 7 MVPs, 2 championships. Why were those 2 championships so far apart in his prime? Why do you
because
think?
I think they underachieved. I absolutely think they underachieved. And if you look at that group and you go, Andrew Gaze, Hall of Fame, Leonard Copton, Hall of Fame, Mark Bredke, Hall of Fame. They had 3 Hall of Famers.
Mm.
And remember, then they also had a couple of other guys, Dave Colbert, Dave Simmons. You know, they not like they were poorly off for imports. And then come the second group, the second time around when they won, I think Marcus Timmons has come in. You know, they had really good quality teams. So I have always thought they underachieved. I thought in 2002, when the final was between the Adelaide 36ers and West Sydney Razorbacks, Melbourne Tigers should have won that championship. They weren't even in the final. So
what do you suppose? Like, why the underachievement?
I don't know that they're competitive professional sports, and so they don't go out there on the floor not wanting to win. I just wonder sometimes that their commitment to winning, whether that was as serious as the commitment of some of their opponents. Because you come up against the Southeast Melbourne Magic, they're going to want to eat your children. They're going to try and kill you. You know, that they would leave no stone unturned to win. Your Perth Wildcats, when they're sort of becoming this powerhouse that they are, these are clubs that would leave it all out there. I think Melbourne Tigers still had a little bit of that family kind of friendly, well, it's sport, okay, well, we did well, we played our role in this fantastic game, sadly we didn't win, whereas the other team's going, yeah, we don't give a damn that it was a good game or a bad game, we just wanted to win. And I felt that they didn't have the killer instinct in a lot of instances, especially 2002. They should have, you know, if you say they won two, they at least should have won three, and probably fourth, the one where they started off the first, I think it was round 96, and they won the first game against Southeast Melbourne, and then they lost the series. so there's at least four they should have won. I've always felt they underachieved. For a team that has three Hall of Famers and imports and good quality Australians of the nature of a Warwick Giddey, you know, guys like that, that were role players that were prepared to put their body on the line, that wasn't good enough.
Same answer as to why they never finished on top of the ladder. They just didn't win.
Yep.
You talked about the shuffle before. Did the shuffle stifle the Tigers? Was it an offense that brought the best out of Andrew and his teammates, or just Andrew Gaze? Did they grow out of that offense in that time of his prime, 91 to 98, do you think?
Yeah, the offense was fine from particularly early days, but as the personnel got better and the individual talent got better, they started to tinker with it. Mm-hmm. Now, you've got a question about Mark Bradke winning the MVP. Well, at that point, they had tinkered to the point where he was their leading scorer. He wasn't just their leading rebounder and shot blocker and everything else. He was their leading scorer. So they had tinkered then with the shuffle substantially to get him low post opportunities. They were now adapting, but they didn't. That left that adapting to a little bit too late, perhaps, before they started to go, hey, this isn't just going to get it done for us as it has been, you know. Right.
Let's jump to this one. Why did Andrew Gaze never win a Finals MVP? Now, it's not a true measure of, you know, a lot of great players. I mean, Jordan is, I hate to bring him, make the comparison, but every Finals he played in, he was Finals MVP, and he was clearly the best.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, a lot of great players don't win Finals MVP for a number of reasons. But I guess, my question is, in the times that the Tigers won, why didn't Gaze win that MVP? Was he good in those finals that they won, or not so much?
He was good. He was good. He wasn't great. He was great during a regular season, but he would get hammered from pillar to post, especially in those series when they went up against Magic or Titans, those sorts of Brian Gorgian's teams, where basically it was, let's beat the living crap out of Andrew.
Right.
And while they were all busy doing that, you know, someone like a Leonard Copeland or a Marcus Timmins, or they would pick up the slack and they would win the championship, and Andrew would be, you know, he'd have his championship ring, but he wouldn't have the MVP of the finals. Now, I could be wrong here, but I think when they beat Perth in 93, I think Ricky Grace won it.
He did, yeah.
Yeah, so that's one of the very rare occasions that a player from the losing team was named MVP of the grand final series. Because
Why do you suppose that happened that year? Did Gaze?
He was just that outstanding. Yeah, whereas, you know, once again, there was a lot of that was their first win, and they've been in the league like a decade. They came in 84, that was 93, so that was their 10th year. And I think there was so much pressure on them. There was really a lot of pressure. If you go to the
watch those games, they're tight. They are. Yeah. They feel tight and they play tight.
Andrew shooting free throws very near the end that game. Yeah, and you can see that this is a guy that just relishes pressure. But now we're not talking about playing for Australia. It all comes down to it's dad's team, Melbourne Tigers, Melbourne Church. I grew up with this team. It's all that extra baggage that came to that. When he walked to that foul line, he didn't just go and shoot two free throws. There was just, I've got to get these in. And you start thinking like that. And, you know, so there was a lot more pressure on him. And Ricky was outstanding. You don't get MVP of a final series if you're not outstanding. And if you're on a team that lost, wow. So he was good. Fast forward to 97, I think Leonard Copeland wins it.
Yes.
Right. So, again, now that was one where Andrew was being physically put through hell.
Yeah. Well, are we talking Jordan? I hate Jordan again, but Jordan Pistons type treatment,
yes,
or just
no? Absolutely, that's exactly what we're talking about.
Okay.
Yep, that's like come in the keyway and you'll be picking yourself up off the paint.
Right. Oh, okay. Let's go to the finals of '96. They lose to Southeast Melbourne Magic.
Yeah.
I guess the answer I have for you is, and I haven't been able to find these games on NBL Classic, so I haven't been able to watch them myself. I've seen highlights, I've seen the free throws from Mike Kelly, other things like that. Tell us about this series, and in particular, why did Southeast Melbourne win? What did they do to the Tigers that caused it? And also, how did Gaze play within that?
They won the Melbourne Tigers won the first game.
Gaze had 30-something, I think.
Yeah, double figures. And I'm trying to think where this quote was from Brian Gorgian, who was coaching against the Tigers. But somewhere along the way, he said, when this
Can
team
you do an impression, buddy? Or...
I haven't chatted with Brian for a long time. So, no, there are many people who can do a much better impersonation than I can. But somewhere along the way, he said, this team is too talented in terms of, he was referring to the Tigers, for us to beat them on talent. We're going to have to beat them up.
Right.
And in game two, they hammered the living bejesus out of them. And in game three, they had nothing left. But yeah, by about halfway through the third quarter, Melbourne had just been physically abused and had nothing left. And they
surprised me. I mean, Mark Bradkey's in the paint. Like, he's as big as anyone who's ever been in the game.
Yeah,
in the
you got John Dorge and people sort of bashing him around. Following year, 97,
yep.
I'm not sure, I can't remember now, whether it's Sam McKinnon or Mike Kelly, I think it's Sam McKinnon, comes down the lane, one of the first plays of the grand final series,
yeah.
And Warwick Giddy jumps up, smacks him in the face, breaks his nose.
Wow.
And that was the Melbourne Tigers saying, we're going to play your way. If you want to play this way, this is how we're going to play.
Right.
And you find that's when the Tigers win their second championship. And I got Warwick Giddy to thank for that, because he set a tone straight away that we are not going to be pushed around.
Did Gaze physically and noticeably like just not be able to take the punishment? And, you know, was weight training an issue? Like, Gaze maintained a similar playing weight his whole career. Did he really lift weights?
He's not a gym junkie in terms of the weight room. He's a gym junkie in terms of get on that court and play and play and play and play. And that's why he's such a great player. I think one of my criticisms of the game today is that we train too much and play too little. Going back, people used to play all the time. You try and play every night of the week if you could. Oh, you had your training on whatever it is, Monday, Thursday, Sunday.
Right.
But every other night you were trying to play. If you're a junior, you're playing your junior games. You're playing high school games. You're playing, playing, playing. And that's how you learn the game. That's how you get court sense.
1,000 hours, yeah.
Yeah, you're out there. But it's not because you're doing dribbling drills or you know, wow, look, I can dribble between my legs.
Yeah, right.
I can dribble two balls at once, three balls at once. Look at this. Big deal. If I'm playing you, when we're playing five or six times a week, every week, your basketball knowledge, your ability to recognize and see things early, you know, see things two plays ahead because you've been there, done that so many times. That's what Andrew did. He had this incredible court sense, but translate that to going into the gym and lifting weights. Not so much. Yeah, if you read his book,
get a ball
of find, yeah, when he went into the weight room with the Washington Bullets and, you know, nearly killed himself.
Doing the bench and he misread the pounds for kilos and, yeah, collapsed on himself. Yeah. So yeah. That sums it up, doesn't it? I understand.
Yes. Yeah. And so you were able to then, if you physically went after him
that
relentlessly,
was the secret.
Relentlessly, you could wear him down in a series. You couldn't get him in a game. You wouldn't.
Right.
One game wouldn't be enough.
That's the difference. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. We've sort of touched on it, but I want to say it anyway. Do you think those first five, you know, really losing seasons, especially after the rookie year, do you think that created this sort of culture of losing is okay, we'll bide our time, you know, oh, well, we did okay next year. And it seems like the Tigers were pretty content through the 90s to just sort of plod along, see where the chips fell where they may, and they didn't have that aggressiveness of the Wildcats, 36s, other things like that. I think you even said that.
I think that was just down to – They were playing basketball for all the right reasons. They were just playing and enjoying playing basketball and giving it their best shot. They weren't playing it to the death.
Right.
Right.
And did that culture emerge? Did that culture of like winning, did that culture emerge to beat the Tigers, or was it just a natural progression of the sport, if you know what I mean?
Well, I think if you go back 60s, 70s, Melbourne Church is the dominant club, and then St Kilda catches up. And then we change the phase and we go into the NBL. They're out of it for a while. They come in, they're still strong-ish. And then they start to not have the budget, not have to, you know, not compete successfully. And so then it's more about, you know, playing the game well, being fun to
winning.
Watch, No.
Commercialism? Like, when does it start getting like, we need to win to be a good product to make money? Does that ever figure into the conversation around
this? Yes, that starts to happen when ownership starts to come in, when it's no longer a product of them.
Sort of...
Well, I'm not sure if it was Seamus McPeak or if there was people prior to him, because, you know, I'm over here in Adelaide, so I wasn't following it that closely. But once private ownership, you know, once it went out of the hands of the club, the Melbourne Tigers Basketball Club as a Victorian club, once it went from there to being owned, then things started to change, because now we expect results. We expect to see results. We expect crowds. We expect sponsors. We expect – suddenly there's an expectation that hadn't been on the team. That had not been on the team.
Tell me this one, buddy. How was the MVP award voted for 91 to 98? Was it done by journalists? Was it done by clubs, players?
No. Journalists have never voted for it in this country, because that's a very American thing, because you know, you've got 30 teams and you've always had a lot of teams, you always had a lot of cities, you've always had a lot of beat writers. And here you've had, you know, somebody that's the rugby league cadet might be doing basketball this week. We could not do that here. So it was always it's been the coaches that vote. And that's been in the system
way to do it. In light of what the realities, is that a good way to do it?
I don't know. There's not a system that you can't pick apart. Okay, you know, you go Brownlow Medal, the umpires are giving a 3-2-1. Like, what do they know in terms of? You know,
they're focusing on making sure that the guy doesn't step out of bounds, or the ball doesn't go out of bounds, not so much who's played well. Like, you can lose yourself in these games. I think the further removed you are, the better picture you get most of the time. So I understand what you're saying,
But we're not at the point with basketball media, or even football media for that matter, where they can be that unbiased and that knowledgeable to actually get it right.
Okay. Done by the coaches.
Yes. And that's probably as good a system as we could have at this time.
Okay. My question, 93. Gaze doesn't win the MVP. It's the one blight in the sort of the long stretch of MVPs he had. What made Rob Rose more valuable than Gaze in that season? Why do you think he won?
Yeah, I think he came in late in the 92 season, Rob Rose, to play for the Magic, and they won the championship, and everyone just thought, oh, my God, it's the second coming of Leroy Loggins. He was just a very, very similar
threat.
Very similar sort of basketball player. Other than the fact that Leroy's left-handed, the only difference that I could see in him is that on Leroy, the joy was always evident. He was always having a good time.
Leroy was a jovial figure, whereas Rob Rose was very serious by all accounts.
Rob was the ultimate professional. He was there to do a job, and he just did it brilliantly. Now, that's not to say Leroy didn't. Leroy is the best NBL import I've ever seen. Okay, because he was the ultimate professional himself. But he was having a good time. Right. He never forgot. He never forgot that he was making a living running around in shorts and a singlet. He never forgot that. Okay, whereas Rob's approach was different, in as much as I'm here to do a job and I'll get it done. So in 92, when he came in, and he was a revelation, they win the championship. They go from Milt Newton, who was a bit of a dud, to landing on their feet with Rob. And so now 93, everybody's really aware of Rob Rose and what he's just done. Right. So you're more into seeing that he's getting a triple-double, that he's scoring, that he's leading the league in assists and leading the league in steals. And you know, you're seeing this all-round complete player, so he's getting the accolades and the appreciation that he thoroughly deserves. So
he was just questions. I didn't have this one on here, but Ricky Grace never wins an MVP. Certainly around the caliber of it. Did he not win it because of his style of game, which was set people up? And I would have thought if coaches were voting, maybe they would have seen his importance to the Wildcat team.
Yeah.
He seems an odd one not to have ever got one.
Do you have a rationale? I think the thing with Ricky was that he could score and beat you, but that's not that wasn't his preferred option.
Yeah.
He made the players around him better. So Paul Rogers wins an MVP of the league. And Paul Rogers has got Ricky to thank for it. You know, Ricky even said, Paul, you know, 6 months at your place, 6 months at mine. You know, and fair enough too. But that was the thing, you know, you're maybe noticing that Paul Rogers is killing you with these dunks and moves, and you're maybe not picking off that Ricky's getting him the ball. Ricky's creating that for him. So I don't think Ricky was appreciated as much at the time as he is now in hindsight.
Yeah.
I think some coaches, if they went back to some of the games where they might have given a vote to someone else,
yeah,
and rethought it, you know, you'd find it probably Ricky would do a lot better.
Do you think he was misunderstood or underappreciated? Like, do you think people just didn't see his game, or they saw it and thought, oh, it's not as important as we think? Or what do you think?
Yeah, I
at the time.
I don't think he was underappreciated. Geez, any time he came to Adelaide, you knew that you had to.
Do you think instead of watching it, when you looked down at the stats,
Let's say he's taken for granted a bit. Oh, that's just Ricky doing it. That's just Ricky being Ricky. Instead of going, wow, that's pretty good. That whatever he's doing is pretty damn good. So I think he didn't get the benefit of the doubt. It was like, that's what he does. We just take that for granted, which is a shame.
Yeah.
But then, you know, because there are a couple of MVP winners across the ages. I mean, it's been 40-plus years, who definitely won it because their coaches just gave them the top vote on a regular basis so that their fledgling clubs would have something to hang their hat on. Well, we didn't win many games, but so-and-so won the MVP.
Let's go back to Gaze. 7 MVPs. Particularly in the years when his play or the Tigers weren't the top team. I mean, I sort of went through it and had a look at the MVPs over time. Very seldom does the MVP not come from the top team. I mean, you look at it in the last couple of years. I mean, we had Cotton this year. He was number 2. Bogut was top one last year. They weren't top. But typically, like, you would think that the MVP is just someone you pluck as the top team's best player. So my question then is, did Gaze's MVP years not translate to them being the best team? Or was the MVP sort of not done correctly, I guess, is my question.
Well, how the MVP is done is after the game, both coaches vote. They have 10 votes, and the most vote they can give to another is 5. All right, so if you give your one coach, you give somebody 5, I give them 5, they've got 10 votes for that game, right?
Sure.
Or we can give 5 players 2 votes, or we can give, you know, so that's how it used to break down. So now, after a game, if Andrew's come out with a 48-point game, he's going to get 10 votes.
Right. And then no one else gets any.
Well, no. Then you know, the next person's going to get 6 votes and someone else might get 4.
You're
20 total. But you know, and Andrew was such a dominant force, you could not ignore him. He was getting it done on a weekly basis. You don't go averaging the sort of averages he had. And his shooting percentages, you know, they're not bad. It's not like he's not like he was jacking up thousands of shots. He was getting good shots, good high percentage shots, and he would hit the big shot. He was always capable of hitting the big shot.
Really?
You know, it's just that Melbourne Tigers didn't play in that many huge games where the big shot was required. He actually pulled the big shot out more often for Australia.
Right. Okay.
And you could argue, well, that's at a tougher level.
Do you think all those MVPs are accurate? I mean, he wins them from what years? I mean, a lot of years. Jordan only won 5, 2, and only ever 2 in a row. Gaze won 7, 5 in a row. The years you're going through, do you ever think like one where it's like, oh, geez, I thought Ricky was going to get this one, or maybe Rob Rose gets another, or do you think they were all accurate, is my question.
Do I think he's a 7-time MVP?
Yeah.
Well, the facts are years. So, you can't really dispute it. Are you saying that was he lucky a couple of times? Yeah, perhaps. Perhaps he was lucky twice.
But stand out as like,
There's no year where
95, it should have been such and such.
No, there was never that. There was never that moment where you sort of went, well, really, geez, he was lucky to get it this year. That should have been so-and-so. But you always knew he was the favorite because of the voting system. He's going to have a great game. Going to have a great game. His bottom line is a great game. His bad game is like 20 points and 7 assists. Now, that's someone else's best game of their career, and that's his bad game. So he's always going to get the votes. So, no, as I said, there's no foolproof system.
Okay.
But this is as good a system as I can think of.
An alien comes down from out of space and says you can select 5 NBL players to play a game, a single game for the fate of Western civilization. Is Gaze amongst them?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Of course.
Do you have your five? Did you write down your five?
No, I didn't write down my five. Okay. That was one I didn't get back to. But there's three players I definitely have on it. One would be Leroy, one would be Andrew, one would be Mark Bradke. That would be three that we would definitely have. Now, for your point guard, wow. There's so many great choices from Phil Smythe. You know, people tend to forget how good Phil was. You know, winning championships with Canberra, Ricky Grace, Daryl McDonald. There were some absolute, and then you've come further along to from Cal Bruton to CJ Bruton.
Yeah, sure.
You know, you sort of got, wow, you know, picking that point guard one is probably Derek Rucker, another MVP of the league. You know, there's so many candidates for that particular role. But I definitely have Andrew and Leroy in the two and three spots, and Mark Bradke in the five, and probably in the four. It'd be a toss up between Andrew Vlahov and Mark Davis in their prime. But I tend to lean towards Vlahov because, you know, he would do whatever was required to win.
Yeah, I think he was that guy. Yeah, he was a whatever it took, and whether it was in or outside of the game. Yeah. Copeland's. There are rumors flying around, and I want to address this with you, and not to stir the pot or nothing, but I've read on these sort of hoop forums and things like that. Copeland, when Copeland was getting off or looking like he was going to score more than Gaze, he'd be subbed out. Do you think that was true?
It definitely happened.
Right.
I don't know that it was a sort of a rule of thumb. Oh, you know, like I'm keeping an eye on the score sheet or the stat sheet to see.
You know what the motivation was.
Right. I don't think Lindsay as a coach is spending that much time worrying about who's scoring. But there were occasions where Leonard was seen to be going quite well and scoring heavily, and then he sat him down for probably an extended period. Now, that might be because they had a two-game weekend, and he might have been saving him for game two, or like, I don't know what the motivations were there. It definitely happened, but to make it seem like it happened as a matter of course, that would be incorrect.
That would be crass or incorrect. Yeah. Okay. While we're on the subject, minutes. Gaze got minutes. Gaze's first all time in minutes, 24,496. Second place is Tony Ronaldson on 23,490, about 1,000 minutes less. And Ronaldson got to that mark in 53 more games, so basically two more seasons.
Yep.
He played a lot of minutes. No one will ever get that many minutes ever, ever, ever again. I wouldn't have thought that is his averages are 45 minutes a game in the 48 minute era.
Yep.
Even when he was in his last year at 40 years old almost, he's getting about 31 or 2 minutes. You know, a lot of minutes. Even when you translate them to today's standards. Did Lindsay play Andrew a lot to, really build him up to to get these accumulation of these crazy all-time stats? Or is that, again, crass accurate?
Yeah, I don't think Lindsay's motivation was to set his son up with the greatest stats of all time. I think Lindsay valued Andrew as a great player, which he was. Mm-hmm. And I think there would be times when, as a coach, you do tend to forget about a player. Because you just know that, all right, he's been quiet for a couple of minutes, but bang, there's a three-pointer. Good thing I didn't sit him down.
Okay.
You know what I mean? You have faith in certain players. And he obviously had a lot of faith in Andrew and in Mark Bradke. The year Bradke won the MVP, he led the league in minutes played. So, so that's a substantial stat there, that this was our best player. We're leaving him on the floor, And as a coach, sometimes you will cut your better players more slack because you know what they can bring you. And so, all right, they're having a couple of quiet minutes. Do I sit them down or do I run with them? Do I just, and I think in Lindsay's case with Andrew, he ran with him as opposed to sitting him down. And I don't think that necessarily did him any harm.
You never got an insidious vibe. You never got sort of a, oh, here we go again, father-son routine. You didn't get that vibe.
No, I didn't get that. I got that in other areas with other clubs, which we can talk about another day, where you sort of go, wow, that particular coach is leaving that particular player on for reasons other than winning the game. But, I didn't so much get that from Lindsay. But again, as I say, for a big portion of the Melbourne Tigers era, before they became successful, it was just about playing basketball. They were having the game.
I think Anstey talks about this when he made that jump from Tigers to South East Melbourne. He just looked and he coveted the running, the weightlifting, the modern take that the South East Melbourne Magic were doing. and Melbourne Tigers perhaps not so much. They just had a different
approach. They weren't doing it. We're going on the basketball court and we're training and we're scrimmaging and we're that's what we're doing. That's how we've always done it. That's it. That's how we've always done it. That's how we'll keep doing it. You know, we were the best club in the country through the 60s and 70s, so that'll still work in the 80s and 90s. Well, maybe not.
Let's talk about Bradkey. Wins the MVP in 2001-02. What in 2001-02? We talked about a little bit of a rejigger of the shuffle.
Yes.
Minutes obviously go up. What anything other than that? What led to Mark Bradkey winning that MVP for seemingly such a great player and such a drought? Did he just kind of wait through the Gaze era and then get it, or was it more?
There was definitely I wouldn't say a changing of the guard, but the changing of the emphasis in terms of, hey, we've got this man beast.
Yeah, and he was ridiculous. He was great.
Yeah, we really need to start taking advantage of him. And when they did that, he rewarded him. He absolutely rewarded him. He said, okay, you're coming to me? All right, I'll make that worth your while. And he did. And, I think Mark had to grow into who he was going to be as well. Right. You know, for when he first started here, he had long hair and he was a surfer and, you know, basketball was good, but, you know, who knows what's going to. You get to a point now where you go, no, this is my profession now. I'm going to give this everything I have. Yeah. And, you know, once that starts to happen, your game evolves. And, yeah, I think he was maturing as a basketball player and the timing was great.
I want to talk about modern comparisons to Andrew Gaze, and it's difficult, but I'll give you my answer, and while I'm doing that, you can think about yours. But my modern comp to Andrew Gaze is probably Chris Golding. Usage rates are pretty similar. Gaze has got a slightly bigger one. Minutes, I mean, as I said before, Gaze played some minutes. I mean, at the 317-game mark of Andrew Gaze's career, he would have played 3,206 more minutes than Chris Golding. Obviously, the stats don't back up my comp. I mean, Gaze is 7 MVPs, all these scoring, da-da-da.
No, they don't.
The style of player, do you think the style of player is similar, or am I way out of it?
No, not at all. We've got to remember, first thing that we forget about Andrew is that he's 6'7".
Yeah.
You're not 6'3". You're not 6'4". I'm not sure how tall Chris is, but I think he's down in that range.
He's not 6'7". He'd be a little bit shorter.
Like, Andrew is a big human being. So you can't, you know, the guys like Darren Lucas that had to guard him and they had their work cut out, Mike Kelly, because he's a big guy. So he can post you up. There's things he can do and that Chris Golding can't. Chris Golding is a fabulous player and a great player of this era, but to compare him as a similar style of player to Andrew, no, I don't see that. Right. What I do see is the same degree of self-confidence to sort of come down in transition, pull up and take the three. I see that. Similarities for sure. But if you're asking who's the better player, I don't think you are asking that, but I'm going to tell you that was Andrew by far.
Yeah.
By far.
Do you have a comp who's playing now who you think, okay, if he was the most like Andrew Gaze in his style, not so much the output, but in the way he moves on the court, the way he plays?
No, because Andrew was very, very much a unique player in as much as he was perpetual motion. You had to be fit to keep up with him, which is why when you start beating him up, you're going to get him over a series because he's doing a lot of work without the ball, probably the best player in NBL history
off the ball
without the ball. Yeah. And so I don't see a player,
the son of a coach.
Yeah. Yes. You know,
who gets it.
But if I was going to say who's similarly impactful today,
it is Bryce Cotton.
That's the guy that is just going to go bang bang suddenly and just get you on that moment. You thought, oh, Bryce isn't having a very good game, and then you know, 3 minutes later,
and the attention.
That's the comparison that's more fair, with all due respect to Chris Golding.
I want to talk one thing. I mean, with Gaze, I think it's in your book, Marvelous, and it's probably the quote of the book, and it comes from someone who never played in the NBL. It's Brett Maher's wife. What's her name?
Tanya.
Tanya says about when Brett was kind of struggling to make the boomers or kind of on the outer, she said a quote, and I'm paraphrasing, but she says something like, oh, you know, Andrew wouldn't understand what it's like not to make the team. You know, he's been such a part of it. He wouldn't know what it's like to be at the end of the bench. It's just not his reality.
Yep.
And I guess that's what I'm kind of getting at with Golding. And others, where it's like, you know, Gaze played with one team and one coach his entire NBL career and a lot of his international career as well. Whereas Chris Golding, it's come in as a DP with the Wildcats, leave Gold Coast, that team falls apart, goes to Melbourne Tigers, that team goes apart, United, you know, it's a totally different thing where he's got to earn that spot and earn and learn a new system and different coaches. I mean,
yes.
What have I got here? Five different clubs, three are defunct, six different coaches, and presumably six different offenses. And that includes, you know, the Boomers and everything as well. Whereas Gaze really miraculously played with one team, one coach, and in one offense in a 20-year career. I don't know what I'm driving at with this, but I've said it.
Well, thanks very much. And we'll be right back.
All right. My point is, like, do you see Gaze's his career as this aberration, this miracle of son, father-son offense and everything like that?
Yeah, I well, that was a lot. You said a lot. So yeah, I do see that. And he's probably fortunate that you get to the 2000 Olympics and Barry Barnes institutes the shuffle, which probably was the wrong offense for them at that time, considering you had the talent of Luke Longley and Mark Bradkey and Chris Nance. You had these 7-foot guys. You know, I think we could have played a slightly different way, but that's what they settled on. So yeah, Andrew flourished in that, which is fine. Now 92 and 96, it was Adrian Hurley. So I'm not sure we were shuffling in those two Olympics. So with the exception of a couple of Olympics and World Championships, Andrew probably was playing in a system that he could have done in his sleep.
And so, tailor made for him.
You
would agree, like, that the primary scorer, bigger wing player. Would he have been successful outside the shuffle? I mean, obviously those two Olympics, we think they didn't do the shuffle. Would he have had the career outside of that offense?
From
two standpoints of nuts and bolts and X and O's standpoint, but also, like, was he the type of guy who could pick up a new offense and adapt something? Seton Hall was quite successful.
He
wasn't like Andrew. He wasn't. I don't think he was a starter.
Yeah, he was.
He was?
Okay. But Seton Hall haven't been anywhere before or since, have they?
Since, right, okay.
So you go, oh, what's the common denominator there? So it's
Puerto Rican guys,
and then
Ramos, Ramos.
One of those Olympics where they're not running the shuffle, he leads the scoring at the games.
Right, okay.
So you go, I think Andrew would have thrived in any particular offense, because remember when he was down at Albert Park, which was where he grew up in the stadium, he's walking on the court and scrimmaging with people. No one's running the shuffle when you're just playing 5-on-5. You're just playing basketball. So he was great at basketball. I always wondered how his transition to coaching would go because of the Tanya Ma quote that you gave, that how would he identify with a player who maybe is a starter in a different level, say at the NBL level, then doesn't get to play any minutes at the international level, or he's a starter at the VBA level, big V level, but doesn't get minutes in, you know, like how can he identify with that person when he's basically been a starter his entire life, played major minutes and been a major player in every team that he's been on, with the exception of the NBA. So that was always a curiosity to me as to how he was going to go, because I felt he came from a system where you used 8 players max, really.
Yes.
And today's game seems to be about, you know, 10, 12, you know. So it's...
Some teams, yeah.
Yeah, I was always interested to see how he would go as a coach. I think he'd probably like a second go at it down the track, where he's not under quite so much scrutiny. He gets a chance to find his feet. That was a big ask to coach the Kings.
Let's talk about that 2000 Olympics. It's an odd one because they have a full-time coach, and then all of a sudden, a couple of months out from the Olympics, they scrap their offense. They're you know, doing things on the shuffle, pardon the pun. Did Gaze at that Olympics? He's 35 years old. Was he still at the caliber of, let's bring in the shuffle and really run through Gaze as well? Do you feel like that was the best strategy for the team, or was it done out of a different motive?
No, I think they were, they had played some warm-up games and things, whatever they were running wasn't working quite as well as what they wanted. And I think there was an air of desperation because you're at home. It's your home Olympics.
Yeah.
You've got to make the medal rounds, right? Yeah. There's also funding involved from the government on how we do. So you've got to come out with a successful result, whatever that is. You can't be knocked out quarterfinals. So there was when things weren't working, I felt there was an air of desperation of, oh, well, the shuffle works, and most of them will know that. Yeah, we can do that. And we can get
operating
that
out of fear.
Yes, I that's what I felt, because as I said before, we had a very, very talented team. There was, you know, there's Sam McKinnon's running around and Darren really? Smith and Brett Maher, and geez, it was a very deep team. Martin Catalina, they had different sort of options. Ricky Grace, who should have played a hell of a lot more minutes than he did. And of course the big guys, this conglomeration of big guys that was, you know, like Luke's
Brad Gianzi Longley.
Yeah, Luke's out there.
You've got the quote. You got the quote. You know what I'm going to say? The money. You say. You tell it.
No, well, it's just that Luke said when he was handling the ball on the 45, he felt like a turnover waiting to happen. And you know, I was surprised.
The other one where he didn't get the ball and he said after a practice, every time I catch, I'll give you $50. Remember that quote?
Yeah.
It's marvelous. Yeah. He's like, he's like, every time I catch the ball, I'll give you $50. And I think he was true to his word one practice. So.
Well, yeah, you know, I was shocked that Phil Jackson never thought to have Luke out on the 45 passing the ball. Never occurred to him. They might have won two while Jordan was off playing baseball if he'd woken up to that.
Who knows? We talked about Grace. Shane Heal plays a lot of minutes there in that 2000 Olympics. Why not Ricky? Do you think that would have been better?
I think it would have been better. Yeah. I do. I think you got to have some balance, and I think there was, as the week wore on, it became obvious that Barry Barnes was only going to play certain players.
Yeah.
And that was a shame.
It was a filleted bone.
Yes. Yeah. And that was a shame, because there was enough talent so that you could have got more people in and maintained a level of pressure that we couldn't sustain. I think it was Brian Gorgian said that, you know, you can't defend the barn if the front gates are always open. And, you know, we had some issues defensively, perhaps with Shane and with Andrew even. And if you look back when we get carved up by Canada, that's Steve Nash carves us up.
Yeah, kills
in the opening game, absolutely destroys Australia, and we just couldn't defend him. And right. Sort of like, okay, well, maybe someone else should have been taking a punt at it. Maybe Ricky should have been defending him. Maybe Brett Mark, maybe Darren Smith should have been. You know, there were other things, and it was like, no, we have to get a result. We're under a lot of pressure, and usually what happens in that scenario is coaches don't try anything out of the box. They get more and more conservative is what tends to happen.
Yeah.
So your rotation starts to shrink, your faith in players, your confidence, you know, is shaken. And so you, yeah. And
why do you think that coaching staff went, we're going with Heal and Gates? At that time,
They were their primary players. They were, they were like the first couple of players chosen, selected. So you're going to go with them, but I think they put all their eggs in their basket, and that wasn't necessary.
Did it come at the expense of the Aussie bigs at that time, Brad? Arguably the best crop, Brad and Sneak Longley.
Yeah. And at that time, we had in that 12-man team, we had 7 players with NBA experience. I mean, I know now we're just about entirely made up of NBA players or go close to it. But at 2000, there was 7 that had NBA experience. And it was like, all right, well, Ricky Grace was one of those. I mean, I know it was only a couple of 10-day contracts, but he'd had his toe in the water. And he just wasn't seeing the action that he deserved and warranted.
Is there a bit of a Melbourne thing going on there? Or is that, again, just a bit of fun speculation?
No, I think as I said, that you start to get conservative, you start to get worried about the win-loss record. You drop a game. I think they dropped the game to Canada, and then they had to beat Russia, and they're under pressure there, and they had to beat Spain. There was a lot of games where they were under a lot of pressure to succeed for the benefit of basketball in this country. No, it wasn't just a team playing a tournament. You know, when you're playing at home, you're under a hell of a lot more scrutiny.
Kid, a ball, a dream. Gaze talks about how he wasn't paid a cent for his last couple of years in the NBL. Could that be true? Is that true?
Yes, but there were other things. There are other incentives, you know, like, well, I'm not going to say there were shoe deals, but there was an Andrew Gaze shoe. I would say that. So I think Andrew was making some money off being Andrew Gaze, and and he was the benevolent one that said, look, I'm making enough money off this stuff on the side not to be paid, so that you can use that money that you give me to give that to someone else so that we have a better team.
Right.
That is what I believe happened.
Did you read that bit in his book where he talks about how in the Seton Hall, I think it's the final four, an opponent, and I forget who, is shooting a foul shot, and he's almost going to go up to the guy and pat him on the back and say, like, it's like he was so afraid for his opponent. He was like, I would not want to be taking these free throws. This is on TV. This is, there's 100,000 people in the crowd or however many. Did you read that section? And does that accurately describe the Gaze killer instinct? Did he have a killer instinct? Was he that type of player?
Oh, yeah. Don't worry. They had a game against Melbourne Tigers had a game against Adelaide 36ers in Melbourne. And Jason Williams, who's a unsung hero of the 2002 36ers championship, but he's a deep bench guard. He's shooting two free throws to win the game for Adelaide. And Melbourne takes time out so that they walk off the floor. When they walk back on the floor, Andrew's looking at Jason and shaking his head like, oh, you know, I wouldn't like to be you right now. Like, he, don't you worry that he was playing mind games to try and make Jason Williams miss. So, yeah, I think he may well have been feeling poorly for that young man at the free throw line back in that scenario, but he wanted to win. And Jason Williams made both free throws, by the way.
Would I be accurate in saying that Gaze's priorities were in this order, in reverse order? Win was there. Slightly above that was be a Melbourne Tiger. And above that was be a great son to a loving father. Like, I never felt like was win at the top of that priority list or not so much. I just feel he was a club man and he just wanted to play with the Tigers.
I'm with you on that. But if you look at the reaction at the end of 93 at the grand final when they win the championship, you're number one, you know, be a good son to Lindsay. You know, here, there he is. He's got his head, dad in the head. Yeah. And Lindsay going, I'm piss off, Jesus. Let me get up. This is going to be an iconic moment. I don't want to be in a head like an iconic moment. For God's sake, Andrew, get off me. Oh, and we get home. Anyway, his first thing was to go to his dad, and this outpouring of relief and affection. But what was that for? Because they won. They won. They'd finally won. So I'm not sure that your order is correct. I think the order was more fluid than locked in.
Okay.
You know.
Do you remember what happened at the losses? His reaction at the losses.
Yeah, Lindsay would put him in a headlock and punch him a couple of times in the forehead. Yeah, but we didn't get that on camera.
No, that didn't make the highlight reel. That's not as fun. I will say this though, looking at the numbers, this is the last thing I've got. MVP. The MVP has been a member of the title team 14 of 36 times in the NBL when it wasn't awarded to Gaze, and that includes the year it was a joint Fisher and Gaze thing. So 14 of 16 times. So 39% of the time. If you bet on the MVP's team to win the championship, you're going to be right just under 50% of the time. In the 7 years that Gaze won the award, the Tigers went on to win the title once. So that's 1 in 7, 14%. So there's a differential of 25% in the years that Gaze won the MVP to the champion. Have I just spent too long looking at these numbers, or does that mean anything to you?
No, I think you need to get out more. I think this whole self-isolation and, you know, social distancing has really, really come home to roost for you.
I explained this to a person the other day. When I lived in the UK, I used to play Countdown every day. Do you know Countdown?
No, I only know it as a pop show from the 70s.
It's Letters and Numbers on the SBS.
Is that show with Jimmy, what's his name?
Jimmy Carr. Yeah, that's on SBS. So that's the humorous version. So there's the dry version of that in the UK where it's just literally the numbers and letters games. And I used to play that every day. And that was my little numbers mind thought release. Since moving here, it's not on regularly enough on TV. So I look at the stats instead. Not healthy.
Well, look, as I said to you, though, the system of MVP voting makes it possible for an outstanding player on a bad team to win the MVP, whereas in the NBA, you really have to be an outstanding player on an outstanding team.
Right. Okay.
So here, if you're going to get 45 points and be phenomenal, your team's still lost by 20. The coaches afterwards are still going to give you high votes.
Right.
You know, and so whereas that's not the system that the NBA employs. So I wouldn't be critical of Andrew for having a great career.
Yeah. There was talk on Twitter the other day about with Cam Luke and Felix von Hoff and Peter Hooley. And they were like, how many points would Gaze average in the modern NBL? If in his prime, if you dropped him in, and remember that Cotton averaged, 22.5, 23 this year? Do you think Gaze would be able to, let's say he was put on a team, currently if he was dropped onto Melbourne United, in the modern offense, in the modern defense, his sort of style and everything, do you think he'd be the MVP? Do you think he'd be average more than Cotton?
Yes, I do. I don't know if he'd be MVP, but he would certainly be, he might be MVP, but he would certainly be scoring very high.
Well, he'd be scoring to 40 every
game. Yeah, he'd be down 28, he'd be 28, 30. He'd be around that mark. See, what we tend to forget is back in the early days of the league when it was 40 minutes when it started and 79, 80, 80. Have a look at what people were averaging then. You know, I'm sure Rocky Smith was averaging in the 30s and Cal Bruton was averaging in the 30s. And this was in the 40-minute game era. And, okay, people are going to say, well, defenses have changed. Yeah, they have.
Was that era like give it to the important, get out of the way a bit, though?
Yes and no. I mean, remember in 79, it was the only time an all-Australian team won the championship. So it wasn't give it to the import on that particular outfit. So no, not so much. It's just that the import caliber was pretty high, as it is again now. We went through a period where we've been recruiting a lot of import role players during a particular phase in the league, which I don't know whether that was to do with cost as much as anything else, you know, what you can afford. But now we've sort of gone back to these outstanding sort of Scott Machados and Bryce Cotton sort of players.
We did.
So I would have an expectation that Andrew would be able to comfortably score in the 30s on a regular basis. You know, when Chris Golding had a 50-point game a while back, I think we've gone, it was like, wow, you know, this is 50-point game. And it's like, okay, yeah. All right, that's great, but it shouldn't be that much of a rarity.
It's over 10. It's just over 10 points a quarter.
Yeah, it's you know
five, six jump shots. Couple.
Yeah. Well, when we talked about constructing a score,
yeah, this is
throwing a couple of 3-pointers.
He broke it down almost, and when I heard it, I was like, oh, it'd be easy to get 25 again. And then the day you're shit hot, you get your 30 plus. But yeah, the way he broke it down, I mean, if you can just get to the line 8 times in a game, you're guaranteed to score 20. Almost. Yeah. And that's not hard to do. That's 4 times you got to get fouled shooting a jump shot or whatever. It's not hard. Yep. Buddy, always a pleasure. I'm going to stop recording.
Okay.
That's it. Thanks very much for listening. Rate, review, subscribe. See you next time.